The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
All right, welcome to the podcast. Coming up this weekend, right, is the Mercury One Ball?
Yes, and we really could use your support. Just buy a raffle ticket. If you can come, we'd love to have you here. It's in Dallas. You can find out all the details at mercuryone.org/M1Ball. But we would love for you to just order a raffle ticket. You know, all the proceeds go to help us keep our doors open so we can do all the things that we do.
Yep.
But most importantly. Go ahead.
You'd win a car. Yeah. You'd win a Mercedes.
Win a brand new Mercedes. Mm-hmm. $100 raffle ticket. They're only selling a limited number. And I think we only have about 1,000 left or something like that. So we would love for your help.
If you don't have to be present to win, though I will take control of the car if you are not.
No, that's
none of my policy. It's not official policy.
Okay, let's go right to the show today. On the podcast, we have a couple of things that I think you're really going to enjoy. We've got Brad Meltzer, who actually knew Stan Lee. He passed away yesterday, so kind of a nice little tribute on Stan Lee. We also look at Israel and what is happening over there, and the United Kingdom. And what is happening over there?
Also, a really interesting thing, a quiz about the words that you say and how it identifies where you're from. They're now able to think about this as far as we didn't get into this when, during the actual podcast, but think about this when it comes to data, right? All the data we give away.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just by answering a few questions, they can pretty much specifically target where you're from, where you grew up, just by the words that you use for common phrases.
They targeted Stu, but they missed me. But it's interesting what they did say. Mm-hmm. Also, Monica Lewinsky is talking about the blue spinach dress. All this.
Why would you say that?
That's what she said. That's what she said. When the podcast begins. Here we go.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program. It's Tuesday, November 13th.
Home Title Lock is actually a company that Stu introduced me to, I don't know, about 6 months ago or so. And I had no idea. I had no idea people could literally take your title of your house and claim to own your house, and then you're done. You're out.
Yeah. I mean, they can borrow, you know, take big loans out of, you know, with banks against your equity, and then you're stuck with bills. Not something that you want to happen.
And it's really, you know, when they demonstrated it, they came here and they demonstrated it.
Terrifying.
How easy it is. You're like, what? I mean, this may have already happened to you. This could be happening to your parents. Imagine somebody just taking your title. They own your house. The bank, then they go to another bank and they say, hey, I want to take out a $100,000 equity loan. They take the money. They leave. You start getting bills. You never took that loan out.
Yeah, and the only way you can get rid of this possibility is by going to Home Title Lock. They have a $100 search. It's a free title scan. They'll do it for you when you go to HomeTitleLock.com and sign up. Why not take the free value here and knock this problem out? It's one of the fastest growing crimes in America, home title fraud. So go to HomeTitleLock.com right now. It's HomeTitleLock.com.
Glenn Beck.
Brenda Snipes. Don't you just love Broward County? Oh, Broward County. You've got the best in sheriffs. You have the best in election supervisors. You have the best in school boards. Boy, Broward County, you ought to be mighty proud. She is, she might want to remove the Broward County election supervisor from her LinkedIn profile pretty soon. In fact, she might want to just delete her profile altogether. While she's at it, maybe a name change. Because things aren't really going well for Brenda Snipes. All signs are now pointing towards Snipes getting removed from office by Governor Rick Scott or his likely successor, Ron DeSantis. That is, if Florida ever finishes counting votes or counting hands. I don't know if they're doing a show of hands now. However, Florida does its elections now. Every day it seems to be more and more like a Dave Barry novel down in Florida. So I'm not really sure how they do it, but they should finish pretty soon. Florida is in the middle of three statewide recounts for the U.S. Senate and governor's races, plus the one that really has the nation on the edge of its seat, the state agriculture commissioner. How is that one going to land? You know it's bad when Democrats start losing support from fellow Democrats, as Snipes has. One state Senate Democrat who declined to be named told Politico he hopes Snipes will quit soon. Quote, otherwise she's a goner, end quote. Now, she is accused of a laundry list of no-nos, including a 2016 mailing that went out to an unknown member of absentee ballots that left off the proposed state constitutional amendment. Oops. I forgot to include that constitutional amendment thingy. Sorry about that. Also in 2016, she posted early voting numbers online half an hour before the polls closed. Half an hour before the polls closed. When did that happen before in Florida and it caused some problems? I remember the 2000 election. Well, why learn from that? She also was opening ballots in private. What could happen? After last week's election, in the middle of the night, her office suddenly uploaded tens of thousands of new ballots that caused Governor Scott's margin to fall below 0.5% lead in his Senate race against Bill Nelson. That triggered a manual recount. But who doesn't upload thousands of new voters, you know, after the election? There's a lot more problems with the Broward County Elections Office, but, you know, we only have 3 hours. If nothing else, it is clear that Snipes is guilty of extreme incompetence with the missed deadlines, discovering ballots in the couch cushions. As county election supervisor, you know, you really only have to prepare one big event, you know, every 2 years. It's kind of like Santa Claus screwing up Christmas, and he takes every other Christmas off.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Yesterday, some news broke that actually kind of made me sad, and surprisingly, because I didn't grow up with comic books. I didn't. I never really understood them until I had a son, and I wanted him to read, and the only thing I could get him to read early on were comic books. And so we went out and we started reading Spider-Man and, I'm trying to think of what else we read, but, mainly Spider-Man is where we started. And then the movie started coming out. And we really started to get into it, and then we started kind of collecting some comic books, and it's been fun with my son. And I have become such a big fan of Stan Lee because I really truly believe he is probably the closest thing in our generation to Walt Disney. Walt Disney was a storyteller, period. And his stories were so impactful for so long that they actually helped shape America and now the world. And imagine a world without Walt Disney. No Mickey Mouse, no Disneyland, no Disney World, none of the Disney movies. Imagine our childhood without Mary Poppins and without all of these things that we all grew up on as staples. I think Stan Lee is that guy for this generation. And his characters were endless and so well written and so well thought out. He created his own universe, and it's remarkable what he did. Yesterday was kind of a sad day, but in a good way. When Walt Disney died, nobody understood his plans. Nobody understood his vision of where he was going next. Luckily, people do understand. And they respect his vision, and the Marvel Universe will continue to expand long after his death. Brad Meltzer, who is the author of many children's books and really great novels as well, is with us. His new book out, I Am Neil Armstrong. I thought of you, Brad, when I saw this yesterday, because I know at least you're a big DC comic fan. I assume that you're also a Stan Lee fan.
Oh, Glenn, listen, I knew Stan. When I started researching my book about the creation of Superman, I did a book called The Book of Lies many years ago. Everyone said, you got to talk to Stan Lee. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's Marvel and this is DC. But he knew Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who created Superman. They were all kids at the same time. They were young, 17-year-old kids gave us Superman, teenagers from Cleveland, Ohio. And Stan Lee was this Jewish kid from, you know, from New York, who was Stan Lieber was his name. And what they were telling, as you said so eloquently, is the same story that Walt Disney gave us. It wasn't just the story of a mouse or the story of Spider-Man. It was the story of us. It was the American dream that he was giving us. And Walt Disney's era, he gave us innocence at a time when we needed it and wanted it so desperately. And Stan Lee certainly gave, you know, co-created Spider-Man and the X-Men and Hulk and Iron Man and all these characters we know and love. But what he gave me personally was a creed to live by, principles to honor, and the way to behave toward other people, that you should be good as opposed to being bad. And I think that that, to me, is his greatest legacy, is that we could, you know, the reason those lessons are so powerful is because we can use his lessons to this very day. You know, no corporation or advertising or politician stands for good's sake. Stan Lee, yes, he made money years later, but not at the start. I mean, he wrote those heroes that were just doing good because you had to do good. That was better than anything else. And, man, we need that today. Look where the country is today. We need that again. If you know, we're great at fighting. We learned how to fight. But when you're fighting for yourself and you're fighting for power, or you're fighting for money, you've already lost. And I would much rather honor Stan Lee's stories where the characters fight because it's just the right thing to do.
So, Brad, I've really been taken by the fact that Spider-Man and all of these, you know, Captain America, all these heroes came at a time when people felt powerless. You know, World War II and then the Cold War, those were frightening times for people because they didn't feel they had control over their, you know, their life, really. It could be taken by a foreign power and a menace that was so far beyond evil with the Nazis that they couldn't get their arms around it. And then with the Cold War, the same thing, devices that they just, that you're defenseless against a nuclear missile. And they were at their peak at that point. And then they kind of fell, you know, to a normal level. And then when we need these heroes again, and when heroes are gone and we feel like we don't have any power over our life, we go back to Stan Lee stories and we're looking for those heroes, superheroes, but as you said, also heroes just because they stand to do the right thing.
And that's exactly, I mean, that is the history of the superhero and any popular culture entertainment movement. We've talked about it before. If you look at the Great Depression, the characters that America favored were Tarzan and Flash Gordon. They were characters designed to transport you elsewhere. The Depression was depressing, so you wanted to go to the 25th century and the jungles of Tarzan. And as you said, when World War II came, we're scared as a country. We're terrified. World War II is encroaching on our shores, and here comes a character named Superman to save us. It sells a million copies. No one understands why. I know why, because we needed someone at that moment. You show me a great need at any moment in history, and that's when you don't get the hero you want, you get the hero you need. And if you look after 9/11, when everyone said, we'll never laugh again, we'll never joke again, the first big movie that broke through the public consciousness was Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. And why? Because we were a country, we weren't a country of Superman anymore. We weren't invincible and thought we could beat everyone. We were a country of Spider-Man. We felt like we were vulnerable, but we still wanted to give it everything we had to fight back, everything we had to do right. And it's why 16 years after 9/11, we still are here today with the superhero movie boom, where even the terrible ones are making over $100 million. Why? Because we're still a country starving for heroes and looking for good ones. And I, again, that's not just because we like people punching Dr. Octopus in the face. It's because we need it. We need it so badly.
You would think that Hollywood would get that, and they would it would translate into other hero stories, but they don't seem to get it. I mean, if you look at what the big movies are, it's always a superhero. Also, these really spectacular stories about real life heroes in war. They got that in the Depression and in the Second World War. They just don't seem to connect with that now. Let me ask you about superheroes. Stan Lee's superheroes generally have issues. All of them have weaknesses, and it's not just kryptonite. It's that they are real people. Well, you know, Thor is not, but you know, you even look at Iron Man.
But even Thor had Donald Blake, who was this crippled alter ego. But you hit it right. That's the right answer. Is, you know, DC gave us what they used to call the lowercase g gods. You know,
yes.
They were invulnerable. They were American icons. They weren't human. They were superhuman.
Right.
And then Stan Lee and Jack Kirby came along in the Marvel universe and said, let's make them like us. And Spider-Man, you know, it was his fault that his uncle got killed.
Right.
It was literally the blame was on him. The guilt was his own. And Iron Man was, you know, someone who was a drunk and could care less about the world and, you know, thought he was rich and everything was solved. He was self-centered. And Thor was banished from Asgard. The original origin is because he became so full of himself. Odin said, I'm going to make you a human being. And suddenly the Marvel Universe came and gave everyone the best story of all, our own story. There's nothing better. The greatest stories, whether it's biblical or Superman or Spider-Man, but the greatest stories in the whole universe are not the stories about other people. They're the stories that tell us something about ourselves. That's why the Bible is written in story. It's not written with just, you know, here's the Ten Commandments and then here's all the list of things to do. They're certainly embedded in there, but they're all told in story because there's nothing more powerful than an idea. And all the story is all those ideas knitted together like a raft.
I'm trying to
carry other people.
I'm trying to remember the guy who studied heroes wrote, what is it? Hero of a Thousand Faces, or, but he's the guy who helped George Lucas put together Star Wars. And he talks about all of the heroes of the Bible and this and all of the legends around the world. And they all just do kind of boil down to the best ones are the ones that are
right, the hero's journey. And they have a different, each one is a different archetype. And Stan Lee was, you know, he was the man, you know, Stan Lee was a great storyteller who was also a master salesman. That's what he and Walt Disney had in common. Great storyteller, also a master salesman. But the reason they were so powerful is they embedded those heroes with the side, with that sprinkling of us. And you know, I think I actually brought, this was one of Stan Lee's soapboxes. He used to write them in the back of his comic books. And everyone always says, you know, why they take heroes today and make them all about, you know, issues. And they were always about issues. They were always about what the world was dealing with.
Yeah.
And Stan Lee, these are his words. If it's okay to read it.
Yeah.
And he says, let's lay it right on the line. Bigotry and racism are among the deadliest social ills plaguing the world today. And he's like, but unlike a team of costumed supervillains, they can't be halted with a punch in the face. And he says, and this is the most important part, the only way to destroy them, those racists out there, is to expose them, to reveal them for the insidious evils they really are. The bigot is an unreasoning hater, one who hates blindly, fanatically, indiscriminately. If his hang-up is black men, he hates all black men. If he hates, if a redhead offended him, he hates all redheads. If some foreign beast beat him at a, to a job, he's down on all foreigners. He hates people he's never seen, people he's never known, with equal intensity, with equal venom. And he says that, you know, only if man is ever to be worth his destiny, we must fill our hearts with tolerance. For then and only then will we be truly worthy of the concept that man was created in the image of God, a God who calls all his children. That was in a comic book back in the 60s. That's Stan Lee writing. And that's where the Black Panther came from. And that's where the X-Men came from, is, you know, all these people out there that he spoke for and that said, yeah, I need help. It was a civil rights movement. It was, you know, the X-Men was, it was always an allegory for African-Americans who were different and hated for being different. And I love that he took all those issues on full force.
Yeah, Brad, you posted a bunch of these yesterday on Twitter, and it was amazing to read that because I'm not a big comic book fan per se. But looking at that and comparing it to the sort of entertainment that is now pushed to young people, it's like these Stan Lee's messages were all he was fighting against things that were overtly bad and fighting for things that were overtly good. And now we have a situation where, you know, things like, you know, promiscuity and anti-God messages and anti-American messages are so prevalent in so much of the entertainment today. I really found that to be a stark contrast.
No, listen, not just entertainment. Look at our politics. It's our entire world. I feel like in a strange, odd way, and I appreciate you reading those. They were so vital to understand, is we've just become a culture that fights well. But we don't. We are not a culture that speaks well to each other, that tolerates each other, that looks at differences and sees something that, you know, we all have the same things in common. We all want to be safe. We want a loving family. We want to love and be loved. All of us. I don't care who you are. Everyone out there that is your opposite political view has hopes and dreams, and they have the same ones you do. And I love that Stan Lee could use his soapbox to put those messages out there. And he just did it. He just put them all into costumes and the message got to us. So, and it gets to us today.
Brad Meltzer, I've been following Stan Lee's life here in the last couple of months, and it didn't seem like he was having a good go of it. He had problems with his daughter. He had problems with the two business partners he had sued for $1 billion. His wife had just passed away, 69 years of marriage. Was he happy in the end, do you think?
You know, the last I heard from him, he was actually very kind to me when the last Thriller came out and promoted it. And, you know, he always had a smile on his face. I obviously heard the same story as you did. I spoke to his office yesterday. I have a dear friend who works with him and said, "How are you all doing?" I think some of the things we heard were true and some weren't. And I think the biggest devastation was the loss of his wife. Yeah. You know what? To make it 69 years and go out at 95, I feel like we should all have such problems.
Yeah.
That's a life to emulate. So I'm choosing the Stan Lee route and choosing to see the better side of it rather than focus on what clearly were a rough 6 months.
Thank you very much, Brad. I really, really appreciate it.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck Program.
Like listening to this podcast? If you're not a subscriber, become one now on iTunes. And while you're there, do us a favor and rate the show.
We are so grateful to have Relief Factor. Not only as a sponsor, but I am grateful myself for having Relief Factor.
I'm grateful, too, because I had to deal with you before you took
up.
And it was awful. Now that you take it, at least you're only moderately unpleasant.
You know, if you ever get to a point to where you can't open a jar or you can't open a bottle top because the pain is too bad.
Yeah.
You know, especially as a man, it plays with you, and it plays with you hard. Just playing with your grandkids. If you can't play with your kids or your grandkids because of pain, would you please try Relief Factor? 100% drug-free, created by doctors. 4 key ingredients that help your body fight against inflammation, where most of our pain comes from. It's worked for me. Please try it. Relief Factor. Order their 3-week quick start. You're out $20 if it doesn't work, but 70% of those who try it for 3 weeks, it works and they order month after month. ReliefFactor.com. There are some important things going on in the world, but we don't seem to care about those anymore. But there is one thing that I think you're going to start hearing in the media, and it is possible to, you know, spiral out of control into something much, much bigger and broader. You're going to hear from probably all the media and multiple world leaders and maybe even the glorified UN. They're going to say this: Israel attacked Gaza. The IDF has launched multiple airstrikes aimed at the poor Palestinians. And now, is Israel planning on invading? It's the same old song and dance, and people actually have the balls to call me an anti-Semite for criticizing George Soros. These are the same media outlets, world leaders, that will actually call Donald Trump an inciter of anti-Semitism. Forget the fact that he moved the U.S. embassy into Jerusalem. As you know, it's crazy, but that's the capital of Israel. And he also scuttled the Iran deal. They love him in Israel. They'll prop up people like President Obama for giving real anti-Semites, people like the Ayatollah Khomeini. They gave him billions of dollars that literally had no other purpose for that money other than to go and kill Jews. That's how that money was used. The world has gone completely and absolutely insane. Now, here's what's really going on in Israel. It's kind of long, but let me quote this from the Hamas charter because it says everything. I want to point out that Hamas is a terrorist organization, and anyone who says you can have peace with Hamas doesn't know who Hamas is and who Hamas says they are. This is their charter. The Islamic Resistance Movement believes that the land Israel, Palestine, is an Islamic land consecrated for future Muslim generations until Judgment Day. It or any part of it shall not be squandered. It nor any part of it should be given up. Neither a single Arab country nor all Arab countries, neither any king or president, nor all the kings and presidents, neither any organization nor all of them, be they Palestine or Arab, possess the right to give this land away. So anybody who says, well, you know, the Jews, they're just using the Bible. They're just saying it's some Bible. It's a religious thing. What do you think this means? Palestine is Islamic land consecrated for Muslim generations until Judgment Day. Initiatives and so-called peaceful solutions and international conferences are in contradiction to the principles of the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas. I wonder how good of a partner they're going to be at the negotiating table. There is no peace. Forget about justice. There is no peace. Justice for them is the destruction of Israel, and they will pursue that regardless of whether the international community tries to broker a peace deal or not. It will never stop. Hamas wants Israel destroyed simply for existing. They want Jews dead simply for being alive. That is the plain truth. Read their charter. Now, here's what's happening. Over the last 72 hours, over 400 rockets have been fired by Hamas into Israel. Rockets fired directly at Jewish civilians. Now, this is the largest escalation of rocket fire Hamas has ever done. They shoot at Israeli civilians, and then they hide behind Palestinian civilians. So how do you get a terror organization, you know, how are they getting a pass with a global community? Well, who but an actual anti-Semite would justify the killings of Jews by terrorists? This is hurtling towards a much larger conflict. Remember, this involves Russia, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Iran. The IDF is moving additional troops and armor to the border now. A limited ground invasion is possible. Will Hezbollah join in the fight from Lebanon? It is possible. Will the Iranian troops that have been setting up shop in Syria join in as well? It is all possible. I had somebody in my office yesterday. He was a Jewish businessman. He said, I was in Israel a few years ago. And he said, I saw people wearing these T-shirts everywhere, said Glenn Beck, and Restoring Courage. He said, what was that all about? I said, I have this gift and this burden sometimes that I can see the direction that the world is going. I'm bad at timing, but I see the direction. And I wanted my children and I wanted my audience to make a decision of who they would be as the world hurtles again towards nightmares. Because anti-Semitism, when Marxism is on the rise, anti-Semitism is always on the rise. When banks go down, anti-Semitism is always on the rise. I've said this to you recently, but I want you to hear it again. The things that I have talked about, the things that I have said you have to prepare for, and they're going to be tough times, but we're going to make it because we're going to make it together. And you have to be prepared to know who you are. Those times are now here. They're upon us. And if you haven't started preparing mentally and spiritually and physically, you need to. You need to. Because we're not going to find leaders at the UN, and we're not going to find leaders in Washington. And you know what? Those leaders are not going to be the ones the people turn to anyway. We're going to be turning to each other. And that's really our choice. Are we going to turn on each other, or will we turn to each other? Prayers for Israel and prayers for the Palestinian people who are being used by, I think, evil forces. But prayers for all of them. Prayers for peace.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck Program.
Christian mother Asia Bibi continues to remain in Pakistan despite open threats against her life from Islamic radicals who are desperate to, quote, finish the job and execute the harmless mother of two, despite the fact that she was acquitted by the Supreme Court on bogus charges of blasphemy. This is the opening paragraph from Will Maul. Asia Bibi's life still in grave danger as she desperately seeks asylum in the West. From faithwire.com. Will, welcome to the program. Are you there, Will?
I'm here, yeah.
Yes. I'm gravely concerned about this and what it says about the United Kingdom, and I wanted to get your perspective. But first, fill the audience in just a little bit on who she is.
Yeah, so Asia Bibi, she's a 53-year-old Pakistani Christian woman who about 10 years ago, actually in 2009, was convicted on charges of blasphemy. And that was basically as a result of her getting into an argument with a group of women while she was working on her farm. The women accused her of drinking from the same tap as them and said, because you're a Christian, you know, we think you're unclean, and actually this is offensive. And she then allegedly responded, well, Jesus Christ died for my sins, and what did the Prophet Muhammad do for you? That has since now been proved to actually be wrong. She didn't say that at all. But at the time, that was what they claimed, and a big, you know, she got mobbed at her house, arrested, and was tried and then convicted in 2010 of blasphemy.
Let me just make a comment here. If your God can't handle some earthling saying, well, Jesus Christ died for my sins, what has your God done for you? If he can't handle that, your God ain't powerful enough. If he needs you to kill others for saying things like that, it's just outrageous that in this time when we are rehashing the past, that we have an actual, hey, whites only, Muslims only water fountain dispute and blasphemy, and nobody on the left seems to even care.
Yeah, right. Right, and then, of course, 10 years later, she's in prison, and 10 years later, this case finally goes to the Supreme Court in Pakistan, and everyone's kind of holding their breath because we think there's just no way they're going to rule in her favor. And then they make this landmark ruling just last month on the 31st, saying that, you know, the sisters who are accused had no regard for truth, and that they threw it out completely and declared her innocent. They said, actually, it was crazy. They said something. They said it was nothing short of concoction incarnate. Basically, saying it was all completely made up, and they were going to free her. And of course, then that sparked huge, massive uproar in Pakistan amongst the radicals who are now still campaigning for her to be executed.
And it's not a small group of radicals. This is a major, at least the videos seem to be major movements in the streets.
Yeah, huge, huge crowds. A couple of weeks ago, towards the end of the week, it was getting ridiculous. I mean, 3,000 or 4,000 strong crowds in the streets demanding her death, or at least demanding an appeal against the ruling. And initially, the Prime Minister, Imran Khan, he seemed like he was going to stay strong. You know, he made a public address to the country where he basically said, "We won't be, we won't be cowed by these clerics, and actually, we're going to uphold the rule of law here, and this is the final ruling." And then, of course, a few days later, entered into talks with a lot of the clerics and the political parties, and agreed some things which were pretty disturbing.
So now she wants to come to the United Kingdom, and over the weekend,
right,
the United Kingdom, in the biggest act of cowardice I have ever seen from Great Britain, and something that is gravely disturbing. Mm-hmm. In a nutshell, tell me if I don't speak the Queen's English, but I do. I'm an alcoholic, so I do speak bullcrap. And if I may translate the Queen's English out of bullcrap into regular people speak, what they said was, "We're afraid of our Islamicist communities. We're afraid they're going to rise up, and we don't feel comfortable taking you in. So go find some other place to ask for help."
Yeah. So there was the head of the British Pakistani Christian Association. That was exactly what he's been campaigning for about, the entire time that she's been in prison. He's been campaigning for her release, and that was his understanding through getting in touch with MPs and actually putting the case to them and saying, "Why are we not immediately offering asylum?" Was that the government is just worried about what they call security concerns. No one really knows quite what that means, but like you said, that there might be attacks on embassies and all sorts. But it's very vague. And actually, I mean, I've actually just heard from a couple of members in parliament on this, and there are guys who are vouching for asylum. I mean, I've just heard from MP Desmond Swain, who's just told me he's just written to the Prime Minister with his colleagues asking for to be given asylum here. So there are MPs who are doing this. It's just a case of actually trying to grasp why the UK is holding back. And really, there is, in my mind, there's no reason why we should be at all.
Except unless you think that the United Kingdom, is not under the influence now of Islamicists. I mean, to me, this screams cowardice, and it screams we're on our last leg here. If you are afraid of a group of people and what they're going to do to the streets of Great Britain, or what might happen to your embassies, you are not a world power. In fact, you're not a power at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, we're seeing, particularly today, we're seeing more and more people come out and actually advocate. I mean, Boris Johnson, the former foreign secretary, today said that there's absolutely no reason why we should. You know, we've got a moral responsibility, an absolute responsibility, the British government does to offer asylum. And really, I don't really see why. I can't see personally why there's any reason why we shouldn't be. The Home Office doesn't comment on particular, like on individual cases, which is frustrating. And then there's various news outlets in the UK who are reporting that the government has said things like, "We welcome the assurance of the Pakistan government that's, is keeping her safe," and things, because of course Asia Bibi is being held in Islamabad under guard in an undisclosed location. So they're sort of saying, well, we trust the Pakistani authorities to keep us safe until something can be organized. But the problem with that is that at the moment, the Pakistani government is saying, well, we won't stop any appeals that are lodged that could appeal her sentencing and even overturn it. So that was one of the criteria of the deal that they did with the Islamists. So it's... it's difficult, and I think there's just nothing really else other than MPs writing to the Prime Minister, which Desmond Swain just told me he's done. Actually, I've just heard from a European Member of Parliament as well, who has told me that it's immoral that Britain will allow thousands of illegal economic migrants to come into a country pretending to be refugees in need of asylum, and then bar Asia Bibi, a young woman in danger of the most terrible mob death because she's a believing Christian. If Asia cannot claim asylum in Britain, then Britain must ask itself what sort of country we have become.
This is it's and you know what? He's absolutely right. And this will be remembered in history. This is a very big moment for the United Kingdom. And it signals, I think, to those of us who stand in America that, you know, our ally is weaker than we ever thought. I mean, you know, this is, you know, pre-World War II kind of stuff that is happening here. And if you're afraid of your own population, boy, that's real trouble. Can you tell me also what's happening with the Scotland Yard just started an investigation in the Labour Party because of anti-Semitism, because it's getting so bad there now as well? Can you tell me anything about the Labour Party and what's happening on that?
Yeah, there is. It's a deepening investigation. It was, I think, sparked by Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party leader's attendance at a group, and I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but it was a group which is heavily associated with an anti-Semitic message, and he went sort of to go and greet them and spent a few hours with them. And so I think from that point forward, then it wasn't immediately condemned. The Labour Party didn't immediately distance itself from, obviously they can't really distance themselves from their party leader, but Jeremy Corbyn in particular didn't distance himself from the meeting and condemn it entirely. So I think from that point forward, the Scotland Yard have looked to widen their investigation into that. But of course, that's still ongoing, and they remain quite quiet on what they found thus far.
It is amazing to see what's happening there, especially with, you know, the people who are in Brexit. They're being called all kinds of names. And then the Labour Party's not for Brexit, are they?
No, yeah. very much not.
Yeah. And then you see this going on. Will, thank you very much. And will you just keep us up to speed, and feel free, please, to reach out and bring us updates on what's happening. I'm fascinated by this, and it's not getting very much coverage here in the United States.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.